We're snorting cap rates and shooting up cash flow here at Deal Junkie. Welcome back to Deal Junkies. We are here following up to talk about deals now. We're not very good at talking about politics, so we're good at deals.
It's the BDP, big deal problems.
Big deal problems. So we're back, and these boys wanted to talk about a crazy deal, so I said I would talk a little bit about a deal we're building up in Astoria. I don't know if you guys want to set the stage at all. Like, what specifically do you want to hear? You want to hear it from...
I'll do start to finish, because I've gone through each season of this deal just hearing bits and pieces and then seeing a little bit of stress out of you.
Yeah, let's start with tell us the overarching how you got into this deal and why you were doing it, to give the high level so Mike understands it, and Mike will ask you.
First, it's in Astoria. What is it?
Astoria, what is it today, or what was it?
What was it? What did you buy? What was the vision?
Mm-hmm. It's a 66 unit apartment complex development on the waterfront in Astoria, formerly an industrial site. Mm. This is Mike Nuss candy.
Environmental issues on the ocean. That's all. Sign me up.
None of that. If there were any of those problems, that didn't land on me. I didn't get any of that. So the way I got into this deal, we like to buy deals. We prefer if we can buy deals with little or no money down. And we have a good broker, Mr. Mark Popkin up in Astoria Seaside, Popkin Real Estate. And so we were up there buying deals. We had found a few properties that we could leverage it into. We had a guy up there that was selling us some of his properties in his portfolio, 100% seller financing. So things were kicking off. Astoria's growing, Seaside's doing great, our properties are doing really well. And so March 16th of 2020.
for reference, the state shut down on March 12th.
We get a phone call, and that's exactly what was going on. Our broker had a client, and he was actually partnered in this deal. He had thrown his name in the hat, and they were trying to build 66 units on the waterfront in Astoria, and they had been working on it for 3 years. The developer was a debt broker, never developed before. And he was going to hire one of the general contractors in the area who had built a lot of the apartments in that area. And so lender, they went out and got a loan, and they were going to signing March 16th. They were going to go sign on their construction loan, get this project out of the ground. They show up to the closing table, and the lender says, "You know what, guys? The whole world just shut down for COVID. I think we need to press the pause button on this deal. And we're not so sure where this is going to go." And so, you know, if you can remember back to those days, things were just going gangbusters. Like, people were buying everything. Banks were loaning money. Like, things were starting to hit. I think in February that year, they said, "We have created the greatest economy in the history of the world." And so then, you know, then March comes and they drop us on our head. So what happened in this deal was the underwriter went back to the table, looked at the deal again. They said, "You know what? We don't think the borrower really has enough strength to do this deal. We're not comfortable with it anymore." So the developer put the broker to task and said, "Go out and find somebody who will co-sign for me to take this deal." And
they had the experience.
Has the borrowing power and bandwidth to be able to go help us get this loan. And so they came out making phone calls, offering $100,000 to somebody who will co-sign with them on this loan to get it out of the ground. So they come to us, and we said, "Well, yeah, there's a couple of things. Number one, yes, we would sign on your debt with you. However, if we were to do so, we would want to own the project once it's complete. So let's land on a price, and let's talk about what you would want to do once it's completed, and we would want to take over." So at that time, it had appraised at $9.6 million. As completed.
Mm-hmm.
The developer said what he wanted was 11.2. And we said, okay, that's fine. We'll give you your 11.2, but at the end, we want you to carry 20%. So we mm-hmm. want you to give us a $2.2 million loan, and we'll go out and we'll borrow the money, you know, $9 million or whatever from Fannie. And so he said, well, this is beautiful. Because this is kind of like my flipping story, right? This is serendipitous. He says, I don't want to own the project when it's done. I was just building it because I wanted to sell it and I wanted to master lease some of the units back to do short-term rental.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, by the way, this is the last project in Astoria that they're ever going to allow to be short-term and long-term rental permitted at the time. This is the pitch. So we said, okay, that's fine. If you'll carry a note for us, at the end, so we can own it with no money. We co-sign on your loan, no money. We'll come into the deal with you. We'll own it at the end. We'll take 50-50 ownership. You'll be the developing partner. We'll be the managing partner. So now we got a plan. What are we going to do with the 100 grand? We said, well, we don't want the 100 grand. We want real estate. And he goes, well, I own these two duplexes up on the hill. They're a piece of crap and they need a lot of work and this and that, and I owe X amount, but I'll let you wrap my debt on these two and I'll give you these two duplexes for coming into this deal with me. So we take the duplexes. Of course, they each need $150,000 worth of work. So we put, you know, remember I tell the story in one of the other episodes, I need
to borrow. He pawned a problem off on you.
Pawned the problem off. Yeah. But
smart guy.
Quite a bit of equity in those deals, especially today, now that we fixed them up and got them rented. You know, they were rented for $600 or $700 a unit. Today, we rent them for $2,400. So, you know, it all works out. Big, you know, up on the hill, view of the river, the whole thing. So we own two beautiful historic duplexes now overlooking the river. That was our payment. So we ended up being given these problems that we had to dump a bunch of money into. So that was probably mistake number one. Although now today, whatever, it works out. So we co-sign on the loan. The attorney says, these guys don't have any cash in the deal, so we don't think they should own 50%. We want to give them 0.2% ownership. So each one of them will have 0.1% ownership of this property.
I love attorneys.
And
they just look so dumb when they actually open their mouths.
Well, we were even dumber because we said, okay, that's fine. We want this deal because we're underwriting it. We're looking at the deal and we're saying, you know what? We're buying We're buying this deal for $11.2 million. We think that the project is probably worth over $13 million once it's complete. So not only are we ripping it, we're getting 100% financing. They want us on, well, we want to be on title, but they don't want to give us 50%.
You mean ownership on the development period, not on the back end?
The back end, we would own 100%.
Yeah.
But during the development process, we were going to own 50% and then take over the other 50%.
Okay.
Now we're going to own 0.2% and then we're going to take over the other 99.8% at the end.
Which is, I can already see where this is going, but that's actually better for you up front because
less risk, less cash in, whatever, right?
Right.
Is it less risk? You signed on the debt.
Well, okay. I will talk.
As long as you know how to work your way out of it.
I will talk about the good and the bad of this and what we did wrong. But here's how it went. So we closed on the loan, but the bank says we only want to close. We want to close this in two phases. So we want to close on the dirt and the dirt work first. And then a month later, we want to close on the development of the project. So, okay, that's fine. Let's just get this thing going. So it took us what was supposed to take a couple of months. It took us till almost September of that year. We finally got the loan closed and we got the dirt purchased and the dirt work going. Now, we were supposed to close on the rest of the loan in phase two in the next month, and what ended up taking until the following year, it took, you know, another 4 months or whatever that was, 4 or 5 months. So now we've killed a whole year. A whole year is gone. And so we go into the phase two. We finally, after all this time, we finally get the loan closed. Now, we've been working on this thing for damn near a year already. Now we're in 2021. And we get to that point, and we're driving up to Astoria every once in a while to look at our new site, and there's nobody there. there's no trucks, and there's no materials, and there's no work being done. And so month after month after month, we're coming up there, and for a few months, there's nothing going on. Well, it's pretty hard to line up subs when you never know when your loan's going to close, and this thing's going on into infinity. Mm-hmm. All those subs were off working other projects. This is a small market. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find subs anyway. So those guys, all the good subs are off running around doing whatever they're doing. They're going to get to it when they get to it. So now the project is moving in slow-mo. So we get the project. Finally, we go vertical. We start to get the project out of the ground. And then if you guys can remember, you know, the next thing that happened in COVID was supply chain issues. And so all the crap that it takes to build apartments was all sitting in boats somewhere in a barge. And we didn't have all the crap to build the apartment. So there were multiple times during this project that it sat for months with no work. There was one time in particular, it sat for 5 months with no work because we couldn't get windows. Windows was the big thing. And so here you go. So I talk a lot about lining up the right debt with the right project. And I don't think you can line up any debt with the project that is being pushed into slow-mo like this. So your timelines, we talked about earlier today, we talked about how in development, your biggest risk is time. And so it wasn't the government slowing us down. This wasn't EPA stuff. This wasn't DEQ. This wasn't legacy trees and neighbors and all the other stuff that can happen. This was just simply, we can't get the crap to build this apartment complex. Now, they had hired a builder to build it who had his eyes on other things he was building for himself. So there might have been other problems in there. Maybe his whole focus wasn't on this project. You know, there's sort of a perfect storm of, you know, just the wrong team at the wrong time with the wrong circumstances. And so what ends up happening is on a construction loan like that, it'll term out. And so they'll give you a couple years to build it or a year or two, whatever. And then oftentimes they'll give you an extension if you need it, which they did. But now this thing is going on and on and on. And now we're getting into the end of 2022. And this project is nowhere close to being done.
Capital markets are all up crazy at that point.
So our loan's gonna expire January 1, 2023. And the bank says, you know what, guys, we don't want to offer you an extension. We want to re-underwrite this deal. Okay. So they go and they re-underwrite it and they say, well, now we got a problem. We don't think you can build it for what you said you could build it for before. Your budgets are all wrong. That means that our capital stack, our debt stack, and everything is out of whack, and we got to balance this out, or else we can't move forward with your loan. Okay, well, what's it take to balance it out? And they came back, keep going back to the budget, coming back and forth, and we come up with a number. Eventually, it's like, you know, $1.4 million or something like that has to be put into the project. So my partner and I, who own 0.2%, we said, okay, well, that's fine. We'll put in the 1.4. But
that you owe 28 grand for?
We want control of the project. Well, here's where our mistake was, is in any of this JV agreement that was drafted between us and these other partners who were building the project, there was no mechanism in place for what would happen if they failed the project.
So no like buy-sell agreement.
We just figured, well, we got $3 million left on our drawdown line. What's the worst that can happen? Well, the worst that can happen is the bank says, yeah, you got $3 million on your drawdown line, but we're not going to let you tap it because you're out of whack, your budget's out of whack, and we don't want to throw good money after bad. So you got to bring in your 1.4 and spend that down first, and then we'll start spending money on the project once it's balanced. Okay, learning lesson. So build a mechanism in there. Build some sort of mechanism. If you're going to sign on somebody's debt, this is just like handing somebody money and hoping that it all works out. Like when you sign on the debt, this is still your problem. This is something that you're going to have to solve. So we go into technical default. Loan's expired. They won't give us an extension. Our partner stopped making payments on the loan. So now we're in actual default. Yeah. We're in real default. And so thank God we kept the bank from starting the foreclosure process for over a year. So there's multiple partners on the other side. And we said, hey, guys, just give us the project. We'll take it from here. And we went one by one. What do you need? What do you need? What do you need for us to have you exit this and have us take over? And everyone told us, and we came up with our agreements. We worked on this for, you know, in the end of 22 till about February of 2023. And we got to the end. And the general contractor said, we hadn't talked to the general contractor. Well, he had, his wife had thrown some money into the deal, and he, and we get on the phone and we say, okay, well, what do you got to do? Like, we're ready. We're ready to move on this thing. We're ready to put some money in. We're ready to get this loan extended, finish this project, move forward with life. And he says, well, what do I got to do to take over the project? And we said, oh, you want to take over the project? Well, that's fine. Just give us, so at this point, we had actually thrown some money in because they had gone over budget and everything else and they needed some money. And so we had thrown a few hundred grand into the project at this point. At every time they took some of that money, we probably should have said, hey, we want to own more than 0.2% of this. We want to have some mechanisms. These are like, hey, the red flags are going off and going off and going off and going off. What's the worst thing that can happen? So we found out what the worst thing that can happen is you know, we get into this battle now where the GC says they want to take over. So they proceed to spend, you know, several months trying to line the money up, do the project themselves, fail. A buyer comes along, wants to buy the project. They say, hey, can we just sell the project? By now we're tapped out, whatever. If you don't want it, sell it. We don't care at this point, sell it. So they go through this process, sell it, keep it, sell it, keep it, sell it, keep it. They do this two or three times. Now a year has gone by. They finally think they have it sold. Everybody's going to be out. Everybody's going to get their money back, and we're all going to sail off into the sunset. And we get a phone call, you know, in December that the buyer doesn't want to buy it. Buyer's not going to buy it anymore. And so, end of the day, we say, okay, why don't you guys just let us have the project? Like, we didn't want to sue anybody. We didn't want to go down that road and take years and spend all the money. We spent a lot of money on legal already, but we wanted everybody to part as friends. What is it you need out of this deal? So at the end of the day, we were able to negotiate with them, each one of them, including the landowner who had contributed the deal. We were able to negotiate with them to give us a discounted payoff. And we had got our equity stack, our debt stack. We went out and found a new lender. If I would have continued with the first lender, 6% interest. My new lender, 11% interest. Mm-hmm. Like everything's changing. So at the end of the day, we're taking control of the project. I partnered with another developer that I've built with before. We're getting rid of the old team, bringing in the new, and I will own 80% with Paul, and we'll bring in these other two partners that are actually good developers and good GCs that are going to finish the project for us. We'll finish that project for about $11.5 million, but we had to raise $2.5 million to put in ourselves, and we already have $300,000 in. So now, instead of being a no money deal, now I'll have almost $3 million into this deal. And here's really the difficult part is go try to find a lender who's going to lend you money on a project that's half complete. So the project got to the point where it's framed in, it's got envelope, it's got a roof, it's got siding, it's got windows. They didn't paint the siding, so we got to redo it because it all went to crap. It's in the North Coast. So we had to start over with a lot of the siding because it never got painted. So, you know, here you have a project that's 50, 60% complete. Go try to find a way to get your permits up and running. Try to find a way to get your insurance. Try to find a way to get your financing. Try to find partners that want to come into this with you. It becomes immensely more difficult. So very similar to my flipping story. You get to the middle of a house flip. You've spent a couple hundred grand on this house. Demo, electrical, plumbing, move the walls, build a master, add a floor, do all the crap you're going to do. And then you're just about ready to go to drywall and you stop the project and you go try to sell.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to buy it?
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to finance it? Who's going to do it? Nobody wants to take a failed project because you don't know what the quality of the work was that was already done. So when people think about, when you're thinking about what's my downside risk in a flip or in a development project, think about what happens if your partners all walk away or your money all walks away right in the middle of your project when it's not done. In between the time that you break ground and the time you complete that project, there is an enormous amount of risk.
Well, that's where the word term bridge financing came from, right? So we want to work backwards on end user financing, but you need to bridge that gap. And it takes capital, it takes risky lending, and it takes private equity in order to bridge that gap.
So luckily, my partner and I were strong borrowers, and we were able to piece this together and put together a new partnership with new lending and rebalance that. And we will go back. We actually just got loan docs. I got a text a few minutes ago that loan docs showed up. So we'll sign on this now. So now think of this. Today is what? March 12th, 2024.
4 years later.
I've been in this deal 4 years and I'm about ready to take over the development of it, and it's 50% completed. Mm. We'll complete that project in 3 or 4 months. Here's the silver lining to it all. Besides of all the things that I've learned, I've picked up new partners, I've picked up new lenders, I've learned some new things. The city is going to allow us to have about half of those units be short term, mm-hmm. if we want to run them short
term. On the ocean.
And so the project as all long term, we have it underwritten at about $16 million. If I add short term to it, it'll be over $20 million. We actually have an appraisal. If it were all short term, it's almost $30 million project.
Because it's a hotel.
So it's hospitality at that point. So in the end, was it worth it? I mean, it was a cowboy move to co-sign somebody $7 million in debt to say we want to own this thing when it's done and not have any mechanisms in place to take control. In the end, we will have control. We will get it built. There will be a tremendous amount of equity just coming out of the ground once we have it done. And if we add short term as a component to it, this thing will probably become our crown jewel. It'll be something that we hold forever and we never sell it. It's just worth, you know, lots and lots and lots of money. Mm-hmm. So it will be worth it. But here we are 4 years in. I'll have it done. Our partners will get it finished in the next 4 or 5 months. So I got another half a year until it's complete. Got to stabilize it. So now I got another 6 months. So I'm another year. I'll be 5 years in before we can talk about perm financing on this deal. So we'll do a follow up.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do a follow up and I'll touch base.
But just think that perm financing is going to look a lot better in 26 than it did in 23.
So that was the point Paul brought up, is that we kind of screwed around with this all during a time where you wouldn't have really wanted to be financing it anyway for perm debt. So by the time we come out, the timing, the market timing should be in the lending environment should be a lot better as we come out.
You sat in default when you needed liquidity during a period of time of getting liquidity being really difficult, and made it to the point where now liquidity is a little easier to get. And then you had that duration of sitting in time where now you made it easier to go deleverage the other players, right? So you needed new equity and you needed deleveraging, and the bank wasn't going to deleverage. So you had to go to those other partners individually and negotiate them down.
So the same problem that got us into the mess is the same reason why not going into perm during that time would be good. If we didn't have if we didn't have COVID, supply chain, so on and so forth, we wouldn't even be in the deal without COVID. But if we didn't have supply chain issues and the project was finished, we wouldn't be having this conversation. One thing I will add, and this is a little bit of a pat on my back, is that the bank stacked up $630,000 worth of interest. Not only regular interest, but default interest and penalties on that loan while it sat there for over a year while we tried to figure this out. And these guys were actually, even though they were the ones that put the halt on our project, they were actually really good to work with. And they actually waived that $630,000 in accrued and default interest for us, which really helped push the...
That was part of your deleveraging.
Push the deal over the... Yeah.
Buy the hotel, date the rate.
What questions do you guys have?
Was it worth it? The amount of stress you took on and all of that.
It was a lot less stressful for me than the house flipping was. Probably because I'm not writing $50,000 checks every month to hard money lenders. Was it worth it? I don't know yet.
He doesn't have anything to contrast it to.
I think it will be. I think the lessons alone will be. And I think that the payout on the other end, it's big enough. If this was all to lose $100,000 or make $100,000, absolutely not. But if we can make $5 million, it was. But I would not do it that way again. I will never build another project without this one partner I have who will be on the show one of these days.
I'd say that right there is probably worth it. You have a lifetime development partner.
Yeah. Now, I mean, but you know, while we're trying to build this project, we started another one here in Salem. We built a 26 unit. He had that out of the ground and completed in 9 months and under budget, while I'm watching this other project sit there. And I'm going, me not being a developer or builder, I'm just kind of going like, well, what speed does this really move at?
Mm-hmm. You know? Because you had no clue.
Now I got to see a visual of, I can see exactly what a good developer and builder does versus ones that may not be focused or, you know, what.
Well, and so that's what I'm saying. Well, that makes it worth it, right? So now you have a developer who's going to go be successful 90% of the time moving forward. And so you went through one really bad deal to find someone who's going to really probably be an amazing partner down
the road. Well, that's one of my things I always say, which is kind of tongue in cheek, but I say, I'll sleep with anyone until they give me gonorrhea. The problem is I sleep with so many people, I do get gonorrhea every once in a while. Mm. And this is a metaphor, guys. I don't have gonorrhea for real. But partners, I love having partners, and I like trying new partnerships, and I like trying new things because I don't know. Like if I had not gone, and I partner with other developers that also failed. So if I had not gone through two or three different partnerships that didn't work, I wouldn't have found the one that did because I would have never tried that partnership. So yep. I had to keep trying them until I got there. And sure, you lose $100,000, $200,000 here and there. I mean, you got to do it. Like for me anyway, the way I operate to go find these partners, I have to take that risk, and you lose the money, whatever, you know.
Because you're a deal junkie? Is that the...
It might be. It might be.
That just sounded like an addict talking.
I want the deal.
So we joke around a lot about like you losing $2.1 million doing this and this Astoria project, and we joke around and have fun with it. But one thing I admire is just you're able to endure this amount of stress that I've never seen anyone comprehend. So when I sit and think about what you actually went through on these deals, it's insane. Like most people don't get what you were actually dealing with day to day. Like when you're flipping houses and you have to write a $50,000 check and you don't have $50,000. Like most people can't make it through that situation. Do you think most people in your stage and like your success level have to go through something like that? Or is that just a one-off of you doing this?
Boy, I'm a firm believer, at least for myself, that I don't learn anything unless my ass is on fire. So, I think you have to get yourself in situations that are stressful in order to grow. I think it's just human nature. Like when I'm comfortable, you can't teach me anything. I'm not interested. But when I can't sleep at night, that's where the growth happens. Now, you don't want to push that envelope too far. And I can tell you, as I get older, I'm trying to be more and more careful to not put myself there, because I'm at a stage now where I don't need the deal that bad, but I want my sleep. Like I value my sleep. I value my peace in my life. Life is still moving at high speed and there's still stress, but it's stress that's manageable. It's not wake up at 2 a.m. in cold sweats where you could fry an egg on your chest type of stress. I mean, that kind of stress, I'm not sure. I mean, if you can live through it, it will turn you into a different person. I will say I'm a lot different than I was coming out of each one of these things. And it's really kind of amazing, really. We want to talk about these things because there's more lessons to be had. I could talk about deals we did where I made a bunch of money and this and that. And it's like, oh yeah, great. You made a bunch of money. But the lessons are in these deals where you make mistakes and you jump into something you shouldn't have jumped into. And this is not the first time where, you know, I've woken up in the middle of the night and gone, oh crap. Like I got myself in another one of these messes. Like, and it's like you're just thinking like, oh, you're doing deals. We do deals all the time, right? But then there's that deal you jump into that you're like, this one could take me under. Like, I mean, this is one where this could wipe me out. And so I don't know if I would recommend it per se, but I think that it's human nature. Unless you're willing to fail, what I would recommend is maybe fail on a little bit smaller scale. But for me, I wouldn't have learned the lesson if I hadn't have done a big deal and had it gone south. That's just me. It's just the way I am. So if you can learn these lessons on a smaller scale, what I like to say is I learned the lessons on $1 million problems, so I don't make those mistakes again on $100 million deals. That's where I'm headed, right? I want to be a big thinker and I want to do big deals and I want to make the mistakes now at the $1 million level. If you're never going to go for the $100 million or $1 billion level, that's great. Make the mistake at the $100,000 level or the $50,000 level or the $10,000 level so that when you get to the $1 million level, you're not making those mistakes. So not everybody wants the same thing in life. Not everybody wants to chase these huge dreams, and that's fine. There is no shame in that whatsoever. But I would suggest make the biggest mistake you can survive do it while it's relatively small, and then live from that. One of my mentors told me on the flipping thing, he was my money guy during that time, and he said, the problem with a deal like that is you lose that money, and now because you lost that money, you'll never want to go do those deals again. He was partially right. I never wanted to flip houses again, but what it did do is it made me realize is that I could work my way out of a problem, and like you said, and this is a Paul Curley thing that he's taught me, is you have to grow out of your problems, and he's one of the people that helped me grow through some of these problems, and it's what ended up turning us into great friends and great partners and owning real estate together. Had I not gone off and lost a couple $1 million, I may not have the relationship with Paul that I have today, and I wouldn't have picked up that partnership and those ideas and learned those things. And so, you know, I was just meeting with a guy yesterday, and he's kind of going through, you know, he's doing the wake up in the middle of the night, anxiety, you know, I think we all go through that at some stage in life, and I've done it several times myself. And I think what you got to do is there's a couple things you need to know. One is it's not going to last forever. Mm. These are seasons of life. And so you feel in the moment like it's never going to end. And it does come to an end. And when it does come to an end, you'll look back on those times actually with some fondness of, yeah, I made it. I did it. Here's how I did it. Here's what I learned. And so when you're thinking that you're going through a hard time, and you are going through a hard time, and you're I would suggest embrace it. And something when Mike was interviewing us on stage, the analogy of, you know, we're floating in the ocean, the waves are crashing on us, and it's hard to make a decision. We don't know which way to go because it's the wind and the waves and everything is just too much for us to handle. If you just dip your head just below the surface, it's quiet and it's calm, and you can stop and you can think. Because what happens is, as I get into these, it's sort of like a loop, right? Where my brain won't stop thinking about the same thing.
Stories.
And so I'm running this through my head, and really worrying is just praying for the wrong thing to happen. You've heard me say that before. So when you're laying in bed all night going like, I'm going to run out of money. How am I going to write that check? I'm going to file bankruptcy. I'm going to lose this building. I'm whatever. You know, the bank's coming after me. My partners are coming after me. Whatever's happening, right? Like, you're running those scenarios through your head. And the more you focus on that, the more likely you are to manifest the wrong thing to happen. You have to stop and you have to say, nope, this is where we're going. Like you talked about the book you read in the last episode.
Surrender to it.
You have to surrender to it. And that's, surrender is a beautiful word. You know, I haven't really talked much about how the fact that I actually am a recovering drug addict and alcoholic, but I've got almost 20 years of sobriety. And the way I did it was I gave up. Like, I was holding on so tight. I was the ruler of the universe. I was the higher power, right? I carried the weight of the world on my shoulders. And when I finally decided I couldn't do it anymore, I gave up. I said, I can't do it anymore. I don't have the strength. I don't have the wisdom. I don't have what it takes to live life on life's terms. It's the same thing with a deal, right? And so you give up to that higher power, to God, the universe, whatever it is for you, and you say, okay, I'm gonna go along for this ride. I am not the architect of this life. I am part of this life, and I'm gonna go along. And to have that, to be able to surrender, talk about ego, to be able to surrender your ego, to kill your ego and go like, I can't do it. I need help. How can I go ask somebody, what should I do? I am lost. Like, you don't have to solve these problems on your own. There's lots of people that you have, you know, maybe it's not friends or family. Maybe it's, business partner or somebody else, but there's somebody there that can see your problem from a different perspective. And most of the time some of them go like, oh yeah, you really got yourself into a mess on this one. What are you going to do? Sometimes they don't even give you the answer. They just laugh at you, like Paul used to laugh at me, or like I laugh at you. And, you know, and it helps, right? Because you go like, oh yeah, I got myself in another mess. What do I do? Well, let's figure it out. If we just crawl in a hole and die, okay, fine. Give it all up. File bankruptcy. Let the bank take everything, whatever. I mean, people do that. Or you can say, let's find a way to grow out of this problem. Let's surrender ourselves and let's say, okay, well, now we got ourselves in this mess. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do? And, you know, if you don't have enough money, it probably isn't because your expenses are off. It's probably because your income is off. You know, same thing in a business deal. You know, if your business is not running well, or if your property is not running well, you probably aren't going to find a way to play defense. Yeah. That's going to save your ass. You're going to have to find a way to dig deeper and go harder and work harder and find a way and come up with new ideas to move your business in a different direction, or move your life in a different direction, or move your property in a different direction. And to me, until, to answer your question, going all the way back to, you know, do you have to go through these problems? I mean, to me, if you don't, your brain's not lit up. To me, when you get into a problem, your whole brain lights up. When you're just comfortable, when we're sitting on a beach, you know, sipping an umbrella drink and, you know, playing in the sand, I think our brain is pretty much dark. I don't think there's a whole lot going on upstairs. It's just kind of like, oh, the sun is warm and I like this and, you know, whatever. When you're laying in bed and you're having an anxiety attack, your brain, if you put your brain on a scan, it's probably fully lit up. Every single section of your brain is working right at that moment. Take advantage of it. Come up with some new ideas. Mm. Write them down. Talk to somebody about them. I mean, there's some really valuable things. I think most of the valuable things you learn will happen when you get yourself into trouble like that.
Do you understand, though, how unique it is, what you went through and how you were able to endure that? Like, because when I talk to people about that, like, they don't comprehend that, like how insane that is. The only person when it really, like I didn't even comprehend it because we joke about it. And we were joking about it with Chad, right? Who grew up with you during that time. And he's like, yeah, you guys joke about this a lot, but you don't understand. Like, and he really put it into perspective mm-hmm. for me, where I was like, that is insane what you did.
Yeah, he just said, like, you have no idea who that version of Gabe was. He was like, he laughs about it now, kind of. Tongue in cheek.
It was
but
hard.
But that guy
it was really
20
hard.
Hours most, a day stressed
I don't
out
think
of his
most
mind.
People could do that.
Well, because you're so lighthearted about it now.
Well,
was he doing the time?
I kind of actually was lighthearted about it at the time, just because, again, if you surrender yourself to it, it's like, I mean, I'm just one person. I can just do what I can do, and I'm not in control of the universe. I'm not in control of every outcome. Like, I'm going to do the best that I can. I'm going to come up with the best ideas that I can. And quite honestly, like, even in this Astoria deal that I'm doing, like, God was looking down on me because he handed me a new lender and a new partner and a new builder. Oh, by the way, the guy I just built a project with, he grew up in Astoria. Oh, and by the way, his best friend is one of his superintendents who wants to be a partner in this deal. And oh, by the way, all the subs that are working on my project are all friends with these two guys.
Yeah.
Come on now. Mm. I mean, what are the odds?
That they all played baseball together.
Yeah. Well, I'd say the odds are high, because that's the only solution to that type of problem, right? Is getting the right team around it. And specifically when we're talking about the coast, is the right people at the coast.
The odds of success are great now, but what are the odds I would find this team?
Yeah, yeah.
While my ass is on fire and I'm trying to solve another
$7 million. So again, the only way that project in and of itself was going to be finished was a person that had the right mindset to dig in and then find the people. Now, yes, there's other things put in motion and different relationships that you had that brought those people to the equation.
You're saying the odds that it was that group was 100%.
100%.
Based on the problem.
Because
but
of the problems
that you
only
found
being,
it if you weren't.
Well, you know what's weird about it is I met all those people. After I got into this deal.
So think of it this way. The problem...
I didn't know him.
Right. So think of it this way. The problem was the magnet. That became the magnet. And it took you magnetizing that magnet to draw everything to it that was going to make that problem not become a problem.
I like that.
The other thing I want to say is, you said most people can't do that. Most people can't do most things. There are people that are just suited for things, and that's, as a human being, our purpose is to find out what are we suited for. Gabe is clearly suited to be a leader in the real estate world. He handles the stress, he handles the finance, he sees how things move, so he is suited to get through that. But are there a lot of things that Gabe just can't get through, right?
Yeah, I can't read a book.
Yeah. But you can summarize one you haven't read.
Gabe's a recovering drug addict.
I really was snorting things, guys. I mean, my brain's not all there, okay? Even after 20 years, the dots haven't reconnected. Maybe that's why I can handle it. I'm not working with a full deck here. I'm not playing with a full deck. my mentor, I got to say this, Brian Miles, you know, who I bought the SMI company from, he used to say, because I think he would ask me the same question, is because he was a very play defense, super conservative, don't do a deal unless it's an absolute 100% going to win. And I would go off and I would do these things. And his answer to me, he would look at me and he'd go, yeah, you're just too dumb to be scared.
You know, so,
I don't know. That was his explanation for it, to answer your question.
Okay.
In a very loving way, he told me I was too dumb.
That all makes sense. All right. Okay. So the last podcast, Tribe of Millionaires, Jamie interviewed Justin Frein. I absolutely love this. So he looks at, most people think all business owners, they're all visionaries. That's kind of the group that we throw them into. And he says he separates visionaries from business owners, and he coaches visionaries. And his thing is, visionaries who live in a life of abundance, but the qualifier is who look at things as an investment and not a cost. The difference between you and Brian, you see things in investment. He thinks things in cost, risk, right? And so when you're thinking things in investment, sure, risk is part of the association, but that's the evaluation. You're an investor looking at this opportunity, evaluating everything. That's the unique. That's the 1% of the 1%, where most people get lumped in as being Gabe if they're the 1% and they don't think like the 1% of the 1%. Where now he's looking as, well, this is a risk, that's a risk. He's looking for all the reasons not to do it, which is a really good way to be successful in real estate. The other thing I was going to get at is you do not become a billionaire, have the $1 billion portfolio without development. Investors don't become billionaires. You have to be a developer. You have to build something. And so the lesson that you got out of this, absolutely imperative for you to become the guy that you see and you know you're going to become.
Yeah, the flipping leveled me up.
Mm-hmm.
This project leveled me up. Now I've got a team. We can go out and build more. I can go build another 66.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I think Paul Curley will be a billionaire by just investing. He's not a developer and he's not a syndicator. I think he'll do it if he lives long enough.
He's a true visionary in the fact that
he's a deal junkie.
Yeah.
He just wants to buy a deal every single day.
And
he's been doing it for a long time.
Credit to him. He started his own property management company and he manages all of his own units in house. And so I think to Mike's point is that you don't just get to do it by letting somebody else do the work. And so development's an avenue to create value in the market, but
owning your own is developing.
Yeah. But owning your own company that runs all of your properties and then people that feed you deals and having a great mechanism to close those deals is another value add to the, that's how you can create value in the market, I guess.
Yeah.
And then get there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also he's an anomaly.
No, he's not. You can all
he'll
be
on
Curley
next week.
I think that's kind of the takeaway is we all can be Paul Curley and you can all be Gabe Johansson. Like I don't think we're that special. And to be able to handle that stress, I don't think I could handle that stress before I got into that mess and learned how to handle that stress. And I had to rely on, I had to rely on a lot of things. I mean, I was, I was praying a lot. My faith got a lot stronger. I was, I learned all about, the kind of herbs that help you stay sleeping at night. I mean, there's a lot of things that I learned during that period of time.
Yeah, no, you are just a normal dude. You go home after work and you play Zelda or do whatever you do.
I'm a gamer, man.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's normal. I'm kind of a nerd.
It's normal for like a 20 something year old kid, but
13 year old kid maybe.
Yeah, but no, like I saw, because when I started hanging out with you, I thought I could do it because I saw you doing it, like, mm-hmm. and you saw Paul doing it, and mm-hmm. Paul, I don't know what Paul did, he's old.
Well, and that's a good point. You can read books, you can listen to podcasts, you can do a lot of things, but until you meet somebody who's actually doing it and says, yeah, you can do it too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody listening right now, you can go do a deal today. You can buy more real estate. And you can deal with the stress too, I think. I mean, I don't know. It's going to take you on a journey and we'll see how everybody gets sorted out. But I think you can survive the fire. I think you can get put through the fire and I think you come out the other side a better person if you can live through it.
Yeah, the more stress you process, the more you can handle.
But sleep is still worth more than any deal I've ever done.
100%.
I'd trade every deal I own. If I wasn't sleeping at night, I'd trade every deal I own for 8 hours of sleep. Just one night. Mm. 8 hours of sleep in one night. You can't put a dollar amount.
Well, you did a lot of years not sleeping. You got to catch up.
Well, and even before deals, I was doing drugs.
Those were the years.
I was snorting a different kind of herb.
I thought that's what he was alluding to.
I didn't want to sleep back then. I figured you're wasting your life. If you can stay up all night, you're like living, you get two lives. You get the day life and the night life. You just stay up all the time. Like everybody else, I thought, man, you're sleeping. You're wasting away like half of your life. You could be up. You know, we could be doing lots of fun things.
Sure, he was really productive as he was sucking the marrow out of life at 2 a.m. for 4 nights in a row.
I was snorting the marrow out of life at 2 a.m.
And that was actually super sustainable.
There's Dane again. His satire.
Sorry.
All right. Any other questions on this deal or on life? Or are we ready to wrap it up?
I can be fired up.
Fired up. Yeah, let's go. I hope everybody's fired up. I hope you guys all have a great day. We are the Deal Junkies. Thank you for joining us. We will see you next time.